the world continues to exploit African resources, uncovering labor violations by corrupt politicians and Western government powers. Learn what's happening now in interviews with artists, activists, scholars, and a host of other experts each episode. Listen Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Africa Now is also available on iTunes Podcast, Google Play Music, as well as SoundCloud on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
Gear up and get ready to batten down the hatches. Forecasters predict an extremely active hurricane season this year. How to prepare your family and your business for tornadoes and hurricanes coming to the U.S. this spring. And is the Black community myopic? What's the plan to preserve hard-fought gains and arm Black youth for the future? A dialogue with Donald Temple, known by some as the People's Attorney. Good morning. Good morning, and welcome to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. 1 month from today, June 1st, marks the traditional hurricane season in the U.S., and forecasters are predicting an extremely active Atlantic hurricane season in 2024. This spring also presents a greater set of damaging thunderstorms and tornadoes across the U.S. than last year. For most Americans, to be frank, the closest they've ever come to a tornado is the fictional scene in The Wizard of Oz, when Dorothy and her dog Toto were inexplicably transported from her home in Kansas into the magic land of Oz. Of course, that was a magical, fictional, animated movie filled with a good witch, dancing munchkins, rainbows, and lovable characters. But living through an actual real-life tornado or hurricane is a frightening, terrifying experience that can lead to death. About 80 people die annually from tornadoes in the U.S. Meteorologists are warning families and businesses to review emergency plans and prepare storm shelters for the season. Now, you may be thinking, we don't live in the historical Tornado Alley, the swath of land between Texas and Nebraska, but last year, the majority of tornadoes touched down outside of Tornado Alley. And if you're planning to travel throughout the country or the world this spring, it may be useful and possibly life-saving to hear this segment on What's at Stake this morning. Joining us to lay out a roadmap, so to speak, of how to prepare yourself and your family or your business if necessary before the storm or tornado hits is emergency preparedness expert Sheila D. Brown, J.D., founder and CEO of Lighthouse Consulting, LLC. Good morning, Ms. Brown, and welcome to What's at Stake.
Good morning, Clev. It is so good to be here again.
Yes, indeed. So, Ms. Brown, I read where the meteorologists are warning families to prepare storm shelters. And my first thought was, and I'm going to date myself here, is a storm shelter anything like the bomb shelters our parents prepared when I was growing up? We had no you had non-perishable foods, you had water, you had a flashlight and a radio. Are we talking about an updated version of that? Is that what a storm shelter is?
Well, you know, a storm shelter means different things to different people. If you live in an urban setting, an apartment, an efficiency, certainly your definition of a storm shelter is a lot different, a lot more narrower than someone who owns a piece of property out in rural Maryland, right? So basically, historically when people thought about storm shelters, they were thinking about communities that were very subject to these areas. And so the entire community's network was prepared with underground bunkers, if you will, that were basically designed to protect families from these violent weather events, particularly tornadoes. So if you ask someone in downtown Silver Spring what their storm shelter looks like, you're likely to get a very puzzled face for, you know, very relatable reasons. It's just not a part of their everyday dialogue. It's not something people are taught about in schools. And honestly, it's kind of only recently been a topic among emergency preparedness professionals for the general public. So it just really depends on where you are and what your relationship has been like with these types of events.
So should the communities be thinking about identifying locations for storm shelters for people to seek out during a storm, or is that not part of the planning?
Well, honestly, I think we should take a step back, because as an emergency preparedness coach, I don't look at particular events and then focus everyone's attention on that. My approach is to think about whether you're dealing with a man-made phenomenon or a natural phenomenon, whether you are dealing with a personal crisis or some massive natural disaster. I want people to particularly think about emergency preparedness in terms of a lifestyle that allows you to prepare to constantly, consistently have the things that we need in order to maintain everyday life. So when I teach my workshops, I never focus on helping people prepare for a tornado in particular or a fire in particular. What I talk about is, what are the major type of events that are known that can be anticipated and sometimes that are not anticipated that will interrupt everyday life? And what do you need in order, for example, a cyber attack that could interfere with the electric grid, right? Whether that's for a week, a day, 2 months, potentially a year, right? We are constantly in the news being flooded with information in more prevalent ways about all of the, what I call threat events, whether they're threat events to the air, threat events to the water, threat events in the form of earthquakes or earth-shattering events, right? And then threats from man, right? And the difference between a natural disaster, if you will, and a man-made disaster is the intention to cause harm to property or people. We don't have the luxury right now of thinking solely on whether or not we're going to be prepared for floods in a world as complex, as war-driven as the world we currently live in. And so I ask the question, what does the everyday person need in order to sustain, to continue to thrive under disastrous or emergency or crises in their everyday circumstances? How do you keep your family sane? How do you keep them safe, healthy? What do you need? And I teach people to think about what I refer to as the nine pillars of emergency preparedness. That is, what does your water look like? What does food? How are you going to communicate your communications? Are you prepared to defend yourself against anyone who might threaten you in the event that our infrastructure shuts down in the way that it potentially could, like lockdowns or long-term events that interferes with our everyday life? What about your ability to respond to small or even intermediate level medical emergencies? And hygiene, what about power and light? How do you keep your family warm and in your home lit in the event of a power outage? And I'm not even talking about a devastating cyber attack level event, but just like you said, a tornado or a hurricane can have devastating effect for days and even weeks on your power. So shelter and tools that allow you to continue to manage if you had to evacuate your home or if you had to stay in shelter in place in a compromised home, like we saw back in Texas, where people's homes a few years ago were inundated with water and cold and the electricity was off and they got a boil water advisory, right? And then what about in the event that you can't access the stores or our normal way of doing business is interrupted? What about how to entertain? A common theme about mental health during the 2 to 3 years we were in COVID lockdowns was people were depressed. People had no access to their community networks. Families couldn't get together for holidays. How do you look at what is possible and mitigate those things? And if you can focus on what I just described, you're going to be okay. You can actually thrive under a variety of circumstances.
Now, you know, one question that comes to mind is, how are we going to survive if we can't use our cell phones, for example, if the electricity is gone and you can't charge your cell phones, if your GPSs go out? Some people couldn't find their way to the bathroom without the GPS. So do you, you know, speak of those, do you train or teach about how to adapt to that? And if you can't access the banks, the ATMs, you know, you can't get your money out. Did you include that in your emergency preparedness?
Absolutely. Those are two of the key pillars that I just mentioned. Communications. I'm devastated. I have elevated in terms of the priorities of my workshop. I've literally elevated communications to number two, which is normally food, because in a grid down situation where you might not have access to not just your cell phones, but even regular landlines. Or recently we had a situation where it wasn't clear what the source of it was. There was a lot of speculation, but several regions around the world who were using a particular cell phone provider could not even dial out to 911. Right. So how do we prepare for these things? I absolutely teach people different strategies that we can use to stay in touch with loved ones, to stay in touch with community, to stay in touch with emergency personnel. There are various tools that we have accessible to us under various circumstances. There is no one answer. You cannot ever adequately, completely prepare for a disaster. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a disaster. It wouldn't be an emergency. The very nature of disaster and emergency is to keep you on your toes and to make sure that you are always compromised. That's the spirit of a disaster, if you will. And so what I encourage people to do is not to take a fatalist perspective like so many of the people who I particularly serve, and my workshops are heard all over the world. I do workshops for attorneys in the form of CLEs. I do workshops for churches and organizations, and I do individual workshops and plans. But one of the common things I particularly see with people of African descent, the most vulnerable group in the world, and particularly Black women who are single mothers, is this theme, this idea that they don't have to think about these things because somehow, some way, some entity, government, civic, religious institution is going to come in and save them and provide all of their needs until things get back to normal. And I can assure you, as someone who has dealt with personal crises on an individualistic level and someone who is engaged in the constant training, education, even with the American Red Cross, I'm the community volunteer lead, that is a false, dangerous misconception to have. You are responsible for yourself. You are responsible for your children.
Well, we saw in Katrina, we saw mothers on rooftops trying to avoid the flooding and to prevent themselves from drowning with their children. And of course, many did not prevent that. So let me ask you this, Sheila Brown. Any tips on emergency medical care? You mentioned that. Medical care in the midst of a crisis. Any basic instructions? I know you're not a doctor. Most people aren't doctors or nurses. So what might one do to keep a person as safe as possible until professional help arrives? For example, someone falls and breaks their leg in the middle of one of these storms or something, and or an item falls on them and rips into their skin and they're bleeding. Do you try to learn how to apply a tourniquet, or what do you suggest?
Well, one of the things I suggest initially is to first focus on what is likely to occur, right? There are certainly really exasperating circumstances that can happen with broken bones and injuries and bullet wounds and knives. Those are what I refer to as the higher level medical emergencies. Most people are not going to be mentally or even technically equipped to handle those things. But one of the ways that people can prepare for emergencies is simply to think about hygiene during an emergency, right? Like personal hygiene, because one of the things you don't want to do is create a more devastating medical emergency because you don't have the ability to sanitize, to make clean your hands. You don't have the tools in your home or in your car in order to do the basic necessities of first aid, right? To stop a small bleed, for example, or to be able to reduce a fever or to be able to hydrate someone, right? So we want to start with the basics, because if we start with the most extreme situations, people will just put a block up mentally and say, see, that's over my head. I'm not doing that. I'm not qualified, right? I don't have the money to get that kind of training. So we start with the basics. Having a to-go bag in your home that if you had to evacuate included some basic first aid tools, right? We're going to start with the basics. Can you close a wound? Can you provide some kind of a covering to prevent bacteria, viruses, and parasites from entering into open wounds? Can you hydrate someone? And then as you get more sophisticated, there are certainly tons of classes and workshops that are provided in some instances for free, depending on where you work or your civic groups or your religious institutions that involve CPR. There was an event in Calvert County just this Sunday that the American Red Cross was a participant in, where there was someone there who had CPR training just for the general public. And children, adults, elderly got a chance to do compressions on a mannequin to see what it feels like, how the pace should be. So there's tons of resources. The American Red Cross website is loaded with free workshops and paid workshops that people can take in these particular areas. So there's a lot of information, but start with the basics.
So your to-go bag should be more than just aspirins and Band-Aids. I guess people should also remember, if they're on medication, to have a extra supply of medication in that to-go bag. You know, and I don't know how many days of extra supply you'd need, but that's something certainly that needs to be thought about. Now, Ms. Brown, I've heard that it's critically important to have a plan for how your family can get in touch with each other if the cell phones are not functioning. Are you familiar? Tell us more about what kind of a plan like that should entail.
Well, a communication plan for an individual family might look like something as simple as a piece of paper that's laminated that has not only the phone numbers, the email addresses, and the most important contact information for immediate and extended family members, but also including a place either in the neighborhood or even in more extreme circumstances outside of the state, where if at any point people were to become separated and there is no communication systems for them available, there is no satellite phones for them to engage in, they don't have long distance, let's say walkie-talkies, if you will, or even have access to a ham radio, they don't have any way of communicating. There are several things that they can do, but one of the most basic things that everybody can do right now is to simply go through their cell phones, go through their contacts, take out the many or the most important people that you want to be able to communicate with in an emergency, write those names down, put it somewhere where you can access it, whether it's in your purse or your wallet, because
and their people phone don't numbers remember. Because most of us don't remember those phone numbers.
Yeah, and you're saying, well, Sheila, why would I need their phone numbers if there is no way to
cell
call people?
That's true.
Right, but because the reason you do that is you want to have as much identifying information as possible. You might not have cell phone communications, but trust and believe our governmental agencies have backup plans. They just don't have backup plans for the nation. Okay, so at some point, people will be able to reach out. For example, what we're talking about is a situation like Hurricane Katrina, where people were literally separated and people weren't able to access children, adults, elderly. So the National Center for Children, I think it's called, in emergencies and exploitation, right? It's a national agency that goes into effect if there's a presidentially declared disaster, right? And that, there is a language disaster, if you will, that people really, really need to get familiar with. But the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children is a national network that goes into effect, and people were able to call them during Hurricane Katrina and report missing children. In fact, there were over 34,000 calls about missing children, and about 5,000 of them were resolved is the kind of word that they were using. So there are federal agencies that will still be in operation, right, in these emergencies that you might be able to get in contact with either because they're on site in response to emergency, or they have a toll-free number for people who can access them, right? But the first line of defense is being able to call people that you know once you get access to a form of communication. And then also, if you do become separated and you are able to move around, having a place where everybody in the family knows where they can meet, whether it's a school or whether it's a church or whether it's another house in the community that has the capacity. Or when I had my communication plan with my son, I had these things, but I also had a location in North Carolina that if, God forbid, we ever get separated and it was very difficult for us to find each other in the state of Maryland, we are going to somehow try to get ourselves to this place in Huntington or Charlotte, North Carolina. So having multiple scenarios is the key.
That's right. Emergency preparedness expert Sheila D. Brown, J.D., founder and CEO of Lighthouse Consulting, LLC. And you said that the American Red Cross teaches emergency workshops and preparedness, and so do you. What's your website? Really quick, Sheila.
SheilaBrownSpeaks.com. That's SheilaBrownS, as in Sam, PEAKS.com. On that page, I have an emergency preparedness workshop page called Thrive With Me, and you can also get in touch with me by texting me at 202-952-6123 or emailing me at info@SheilaBrownSpeaks.com.
Thank you. Thank you, Sheila Brown. Thank you so much for being our guest this morning on What's at Stake.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Are African Americans asleep at the switch in the midst of perilous times for their race? People's attorney Donald Temple, founder of Thinking Minds and A House on Fire, joins us for a deep dive into the destiny of African Americans. We'll be back in a moment.
Hi, this is Robin Holden.
Hi, this is Miyuki Williams.
WPFW programmers Miyuki Williams, Robin Holden, Craig Williams, Jim Byers, Verna Avery Brown, James Funk, Captain Fly, Tom Cole, Bill Wax, Kim Bay, Millie Ware, Joni Eisenberg, Arthur McLeod, Donald Temple, Bill Starr, Lona Elias, Ron Pinchback, David Whetstone, DJ Abby, DJ Divine, and Willard Jenkins will celebrate you at Washington's premier jazz club, Tacoma Station, 6914 4th Street, Northwest Washington, D.C. This is a musical tribute on Sunday, May 26, from 5 until 9 p.m.
This event features internationally renowned bassist Michael Bowie, Hope Udobie on keyboards, Charles Wilson drums, Grace J and Sing Steph on vocals, and others.
Please come and join your favorite programmers for some great jazz, food, cocktails, and a little dancing for a Sunday jazz happy hour you will never forget.
The event happens at the Tacoma Station Jazz Club, 6914 4th Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., a musical fundraising tribute, Sunday, May 26, 5 until 9 p.m. The tickets are $50. And there are only 100 tickets for this VIP event. Secure your tickets to the Jazz Happy Hour.
Tickets are available at Eventbrite. When in Eventbrite, please search WPFW Tacoma Station. We're looking forward to celebrating you on Sunday, May 26th from 5 until 9 p.m. at Tacoma Station.
May 26th, be there or be square, as they say. Well, welcome back to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The criminal trial of Donald Trump is currently underway and has captured the attention of America and indeed the world. Never before in the history of the U.S. has a former president or president ever been indicted and brought to trial. Trump faces criminal charges in four more cases,
the Georgia election case, the federal election case, the classified documents case, the New York hush money case currently underway, and the civil fraud case, which is under appeal. In that case, Judge Arthur Ergon ordered Trump to pay $355 million in penalties plus interest. Our guest this segment is the fearless, audacious, known to some as the people's attorney, Donald Temple. In full disclosure, he's also a programmer here at WPFW as the host of the popular show Loftology, which airs Wednesday nights from 8 to 10 p.m. Attorney Temple is also the founder of Thinking Minds and A House on Fire. That's a rapidly growing internet chat group or stream. Good morning, Donald Temple, and welcome to What to Say.
Hey, good morning, Vernon. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. So let's begin with the Trump-New York hush money trial currently underway. One of the key prosecution witnesses, Michael Cohen, has already served prison time for campaign violations involving charges that he falsified Trump's business records to conceal payments to porn star Stormy Daniels and her alleged sexual encounter with Trump. And a second key witness, National Enquirer former publisher David Pecker, testified that he has met with Trump and Cohen and agreed to identify negative stories about Trump and to suppress them. And, of course, porn star Stormy Daniels and former Playboy model Karen McDougal, who alleges she had a 10-month affair with Trump, are witnesses for the prosecution. Now, what happens, Attorney Temple, if Trump is found guilty of the charges against him? He's charged, of course, with falsifying his records to hide the true nature of payments to his former attorney, Michael Cohen, to bury negative stories about him during the 2016 presidential campaign. So my question is, what happens if Trump is found guilty? Will he face jail time? Can he run for the White House while serving in the big house? You tell us. This gets off.
There's a lot there, Vernon. I guess we have to look at that under two different lenses. One is the criminal process and the notion of a conviction, which, you know, while we're all thinking it's going to happen, it's a rebuttable presumption still until there are 12 jurors who conclude unanimously that he's guilty of the charges. If he's convicted, then the judge is going to have to make a decision based still on the criminal justice system in New York as to the nature and extent to which a president in this situation, no matter what people say, obviously he's treated differently, even though people try to equalize the fact that, hey, everybody is to be treated equal. Obviously, that's not the case, and it won't be the case if he's convicted, because then they're going to have all types of logistical dynamics. So I think that's an open question, but there might be some form of confinement. I can't imagine that there won't be any consequences given the nature of this case and the charges. On the second question of the candidacy for president, I mean, the man is not only going to continue to run for president, there is no bar to him serving as president, even if convicted. And that raises a whole nother question because of the what's happening in the country. And the fact of the matter, as dubious as it seems to too many of us, Donald Trump could be elected president. And so you could have a president of the United States who is not only convicted, but depending on the sentence, serving in some kind of qualified or restricted capacity. It's an amazing proposition.
So he could be serving time and being president in the big house.
That's correct. As you call it, the big house, yes.
I'm sorry, a colloquial term. And so... let's also look briefly at the possibility that Trump is not found guilty and continues his pursuit of the presidency. How might a not guilty verdict affect the election, do you think?
It would unquestionably energize his base and his campaign. And for people who are kind of on the fence in the middle, as if he's convicted, it might make a difference. If he's not convicted, it also makes a difference because I think that it would certainly strengthen his campaign and chances of winning.
So we're going to come back in a moment and continue our conversation with Donald Temple, Attorney Donald Temple. And we look at, are blacks putting too much hope in our president to solve the ills facing the black community? And if so, does that mean blacks shouldn't bother to vote? Stay with us. We'll be back in 60 seconds.
The best in live music entertainment is coming this spring to Bethesda Theater. Also coming is Trouble Funk, featuring go-go legend Big Tony, celebrating his birthday by performing all their go-go classics on Friday, May 3rd at 9 p.m. And on Mother's Day, it's Howard Hewitt performing his own popular songs and those by Shalamar. But two shows on Sunday, May 12th at 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. The Whisperers on April 26th and 27th, Trouble Funk featuring Big Tony on May 3rd, and Howard Hewitt on Mother's Day, May 12th. Get more information on all shows at BethesdaTheater.com. WPFW is a proud media partner with Bethesda Theater.
Welcome back to What's at Stake. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We're speaking with Attorney Donald Temple, known by some as the People's Attorney, and who's also the founder of Thinking Minds and A House on Fire. That's an internet chat group that has over, 1,800 participants, Donald?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Okay.
And it's a group. It's just where we exchange thoughts, ideas, and information about that affect how black people think, quite frankly.
Okay.
Or should think.
He's also the host of WPFW's Loveology, a very popular show that airs on Wednesday nights. And if listeners would like to pose a question to Counselor Temple, we have one or two phone lines open, so if you'd like to pose a question, feel free to call in. The number to call is 202-588-0893. That's 202-588-0893. So, Attorney Temple, Time Magazine published their interview with Donald Trump, where they asked him numerous serious questions. What a second Trump presidency would actually look like. And his responses are nothing less than chilling. I can't even say shocking because he used up all the shock value response years ago, I think. Nothing he says really shocks anyone anymore because he said it all. But in his version of America, compiled into a single document, spelled out in no uncertain terms in print in a legitimate, credible news magazine like Time, is to me chilling. In my opinion, he should have been arrested just for saying those things out loud. Things like he'd be dictator for a day, using the National Guard, pardoning all the January 6th insurrectionists because, according to Trump, they were escorted in by the police, shooting shoplifters, immunity to all police officers, letting states do whatever they want to women who seek abortions, suspending the U.S. Constitution when asked how he thought people, and when he was asked how he thought people might respond to that, he said, oh, I think they'll like it. And, you know, there must have been, you know, there might be, I'm afraid there might be a little bit of truth to that. Attorney Donald Temple, your reaction to that article?
You know, we're caught up in it, and I think we need to wake up and understand what's happening. It's rooted and presented to us in the form of a presidential election, but it's much more than a presidential election. It happens to be the vehicle by which this particular energy of this kind of white reactionaryism, this kind of conservative, hardcore, profit-centered capitalism is taking its aim at restructuring the country. But we have to remember that these policies that he is speaking about that are moving us to more of a dictatorial, anti-democratic, to the extent that it's democratic at all, context is dangerous. And this Time interview is priceless. All of us should read this Time interview in Time magazine and understand what's happening if we don't already appreciate it. Now, when it comes back and it's rooted in the presidency, then that's the framework for which we need to attack this particular issue. The notion that you mentioned before, should people vote? It's imbecilic, idiotic for us to sit back and say, well, and to get caught up in whether we're going to vote or not vote. You might remember the day that after the election in 2016 when Trump won. Everyone was shocked. I mean, Trump wins because they didn't think it could happen. Well, not only is it about the presidency and all the opinions, he is boldly, unapologetically, and even insanely telling us exactly what's going to happen. And this is not just black people, but black people need to be even heightened in our vigilance because we're almost at a place where they're forcing us to have a U-turn. You got to go backwards. And you got to go backwards in terms of the political process. You got to go backwards in terms of the education process. Imagine, Verna, you are sitting here as an educated black woman, and I'm an educated black man, and our children, and for a period of time, there are people who have been able to maximize in terms of educational access, affirmative action, that's in a job place, in the business sectors, and the like. Now, the anti-discrimination laws are changing and right in front of our eyes. So 30 years from now, the same people that who were similarly situated to us won't have the same access because there's no bars, no restrictions on affirmative action, and no progressive entries. Based on a history of a pervasive, entrenched institutional racism, which is absolutely insane. So the question is, as to this Trump situation, is one thing, and we need to be clear about it. It's bigger than Trump. It's bigger than the presidency. And it's also about what we as a people, how we're thinking, how we're processing, our in terms of our consumerism, in terms of how the issues that confront our people on a daily basis. These are things that we have to begin to rethink, because the way that we have been thinking about them and the way that our so-called leadership, whether it's political or otherwise, thinks about it, is antiquated. It won't work for us to continue to depend on someone else to figure out our liberation, our development, our collective development, our children's development, our children's futures.
Well, we have a couple of callers that want to get in on this discussion, so I'm going to go to our phone lines now. Good morning, caller. You're on What's at Stake. State your name and your question, please, or your comment.
Good morning. My name is Mansa Musa, and I'm going to make this statement in the context of the difference between being well-trained and being educated. Number one, the vote, people don't vote for the president. The president is selected by the Electoral College. So your vote don't count when it comes to voting for the president. The Electoral College selects the president, and nobody elects the Electoral College. Number two, any indigenous American person that are relying on Europeans to do something for you, start planning your funeral. Cut the chase. Just start planning your funeral. If you sitting around here waiting for, if you are indigenous American, you sitting around here waiting for a European to do something for you, just start planning your funeral.
All right,
and
thank you.
Another thing I'm going to say, this is the last point I'm going to make. For all you people that's still in a sunken place, calling yourself black and African American, the most important thing to any human is their nationality. Black is not a nationality. It's a legal status. So you need to understand that if black don't literally mean black, then what does it mean? It's a legal status. It's not a complexion. We are Aboriginal Indigenous Americans. 1828 definition of American. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your comment. Attorney Temple, did you want to?
That's an aspiration. That's a particular point of view. The House is on fire right now. If somebody were to say that the electoral elected by, but they don't understand the electoral process. The electoral process is an implication. It doesn't mean that it's right, but it doesn't exist in isolation of the people in the states and how they vote and the outcome of those votes in a particular state. The election is going to be determined on a certain number of what they call key states, like a Pennsylvania, like a Michigan, like a Virginia, like a North Carolina, like a Colorado, like an Arizona. And voting turnout is critical. And so for people to be, and this is a problem, Werner, with all due respect to Mr. Musa, okay, because people say, well, just watching. Nobody's saying expect Europeans to. That's the whole point of my conversation with you. We should not. We live in America. There is a huge population. There's trillions of dollars floating through our government in the state, local, and federal level. And we shouldn't watch it on TV. We should have a vested interest in that. But it's not the United States of Wakanda. So we shouldn't have the expectation that people who don't necessarily look like us are going to always have our vested interest, black or white. And so our system, the way that we have to change our way of thinking is we have to understand that that system hasn't always worked for us. We know that. Will not always work for us. And then what if it doesn't work for us? Then what does it mean? We have all these people, and we can debate what education means, and I can certainly contribute to that. But the point is that in terms of our capacity, if there were, and there isn't, by the way, underscore, there is not affirmative action. Affirmative action is dead. So what does that mean? So that means that when my grandson is 20 years old and he has options, what do those options look like for all of our grandchildren and great-grandchildren? That means that we can't depend on the government. That also means that affirmative action is dead doesn't mean that we are dead. Doesn't mean that we don't have the capacity to be innovative, particularly with technology and our global and international reach. It doesn't mean that we don't have the, from a historical context, when you look at what some of the folks like Du Bois and Garvey and Malcolm and others who globalized the condition of people of African descent. Mm-hmm. And we have limited ourselves in terms of our thinking, in terms of our capacity.
Okay. So we have another caller on the phone. That response, I'm sure, was helpful for a number of people. That's a comment that I hear frequently, is no point in voting. A single vote doesn't count. It's the Electoral College that elects the president. So I hope people heard that response. We're going to go to our phones again. Good morning. You're on What's at Stake. Your name and your comment or your question, please.
Yes, Lawrence. And I just want to reiterate, I guess, what I just heard, but also understand we're going to have to come out of our comfort zone. Now, we survived the first Trump term, and it seems whether he wins or loses, it's a reflection on the fact that this country is, you know, the justice system is broken, and even, you know, what other choice? Biden, who's a war criminal by supporting this stuff over in Palestine. So we just have to be ready to, as I said, come out of our comfort zones and bear down, because I think I heard some of the commentary while I was on hold that, we have the resources or at least the spirit and the will to push ahead, and that's what we're going to have to rely on more so than anything we've done in the recent past. Our ancestors have made it through, and that's where we have to pick up.
All right. Thank you, Lawrence, for your comment. So, Attorney Temple, you have your political pundit's hat on. So what are the chances Trump could win this election, notwithstanding the criminal indictments against him? Or another way to look at it, President Biden could actually lose this election, given the growing discontent with his policy towards Israel. The Black Studies Department at Northwestern University came out in support of a ceasefire in Gaza and encouraged peaceful student protests and respectful displays of solidarity without fear of criminal prosecutions and discriminatory reprisals. And there is, in fact, a long history of solidarity between Black people and Palestinians. It has been an element in the Black Panther Party and the Black Lives Matter movement, but there's also a strong but silent group of Black Christian Zionists who, because of biblical teachings, pledge support for Israel. Do you think there's enough disenchantment with Biden and his pro-Israel policy that it would significantly affect Black voter turnout?
This Israeli-Palestinian question is a major problem for the Biden candidacy. I mean, it's obvious. And there is another dynamic. And I think we, when we talk about Trump and Biden, you know, that's one aspect of that. And I want to just underscore this. We keep going back to that equation as if it is the only answer. Like, this is it. This is what's going to be our fate. Our fate is sealed by this. And we have to understand that that is significant. But if we're going to be more masterful about our destiny, it can't just be, okay, Trump, Biden, and Trump, 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 Trump. However, you have to understand the implications of a Trump presidency. As to Biden and Trump, I think that, you know, to Biden's credit, but for this particular issue, Biden has done incredible things, objectively, for black people, you know, that benefit black and poor people and brown people. But as I say, we can't expect that Biden's going to be Huey damn Newton. That's not his role. It wasn't Obama's role. And Obama, we had a black president. And if you compare Biden and Obama to what they did or didn't do, then in terms of your expectations, they're going to get a B or B minus. They're not going to get A. And we shouldn't expect an A. So if you're juxtaposing a Trump presidency with a Biden presidency, with the House being on fire, if you elect Donald Trump, your house is going to burn to the ground. Simple as that. And there's a saying outside of speaking at the Holocaust Museum, if it happened, it can happen again. And what troubles me here, Verna, is that when we talk about this candidacy, I said at the beginning, it's bigger than the presidency. Because it's not just about the presidency here. It's also about the fact that this system being chicken at the very axis. And you need to contextualize what counts for black Americans in particular. We have to be selfish about our agenda in that regard. And being selfish means that we have to do the math, understand the math. And that's critical. Up to November, it should be very clear. If people are sitting at home on their chops and they rationalize in any way a Donald Trump getting elected, we have a problem.
Okay. We have another caller on the line, I believe. Good morning. Welcome to What's at Stake. Your name and your question or comment, please.
Good morning. From what I've heard.
Your name, sir.
Thomas. Thomas Ruffin, actually. I agree with almost everything Donald Trump said. Actually, even what I slightly disagree with, I basically agree with him on. And basically, I want to focus on this point before the show goes off, and that is, Donald said we have to prepare ourselves now and into the future to make ourselves more competent as a race and as a community to deal with this economy, the government, and world affairs. We are not there. We are totally unprepared for now and the future. And us relying on a president, whoever, whatever party and whatever candidate, is foolhardy. We have to do more. We have to make use of presidential, state, and other elections like the Congress, but we can't rely on that. Now, I use this as an example, more of a model that we need to learn from. The Zionists in Israel, they get more support from the President of the United States and the Congress than we get. Donald correctly pointed out affirmative action is dead and has been dead, and too many of us don't even know what affirmative action is and that it passed away. We are not ready, and Donald is right. This is a warning call that we need to heed more than practically anything else that we face. We're facing a possible apocalypse. Thank you, Donald, and y'all have a good day.
Thank you, Thomas.
Can I say, thanks, Thomas. Yeah, you know, it's really, let me be let me just do something that's really simple. In terms of what we need to do, the caller before him said, well, we need to do things. Sometimes we're diplomatic. But what is it that we do? You know, we out there, I mean, we have the Black Caucus and we have all these sessions and things like this. But what does it do? What are we building in terms of, you know, Malcolm X used to say we have to build institutions. And that's critical. We have to have institutions. So we also have to be innovative. We have to be collective and cooperative. We have the best minds We have black kids who go into Howard and Harvard with MBAs and JDs and all kinds of things. We have people who know business that did no business before. But you know what? The black third grade kid, and as a problem right now in our country, is not reading. 30% of them are reading at third grade level. And we have people who have all kinds of degrees. We've gotten so damn busy, so consumed with our status and the assimilation process. You know, so you're a lawyer. Who cares? Who cares what you drive, where you live, if you're being, if you're confining it to your own comfort levels? When our children need us, when there are people, where there are ideas that are yet born, I mean, this is, we can be very innovative, but we can't keep thinking that and crying, okay, woe is me.
Let me ask you this.
Go ahead. Yes, I'm sorry.
So how would you suggest we change the way our black children are educated? And I know you had one really interesting idea in response to the growing Spanish-speaking population in America. If you can share that with us, I appreciate that.
There's two things. One is that I think we have to have a formula. We have to have a blueprint for not just education, but it has to be a comprehensive blueprint of which education is a finger on a hand. But we really got to talk about our values. We got to talk about our culture. You know, we got to talk about what education, as the caller earlier said, means. What do we desire in our educational values? I was reading this week about a school in some place where they, maybe Japan, where they were promoting empathy.
And so,
but I was also saying, in terms of how we think, and it's certainly just a thought, that why shouldn't black people prioritize learning Spanish? You know what I mean? I mean,
sorry,
we do so much for us.
We're running out of time, Donald. I have one last caller. If you can just present your name and your question really quickly, we've got about 2 minutes left, so go for it.
Well, I thank you for your time.
Very briefly, and I can barely hear you.
No problem. I thank you for your time, and I'd like to identify myself as the power.
I'm sorry, we can't really hear you, ma'am. I'm so sorry.
We can hear her. We can hear her on this end.
Okay. All right.
Okay. So I'd like to identify myself as the power source, and I would first like to say that I am very fond of Donald Temple. He is simply brilliant. And to add to his comment about consumerism, that is what it is all about. It is bigger than the election. But I want to urge people to understand that the best plan is to have a plan, as the young woman said before Donald Temple. And the fact that it's bigger than the election is purely based on consumerism, because we talk about how our lives matter. But if we take back our power, which is our money, we will matter, because then that money will be missed. And so I feel like, Pete, there needs to be more dialogue about that. But thank you for this conversation.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your contribution there. Okay, so there's so much we didn't get to, Attorney Temple, but perhaps another time. Core values, artificial intelligence and its threat to blacks, and so forth and so on, and the immigration issue. So I just want to thank you for joining us this morning, Donald Temple. Attorney Donald Temple of the Temple Law Firm, founder of Thinking Minds and A House on Fire, the host of Loveology on WPFW Wednesday nights from 8 to 10. Thank you all for joining us on What's at Stake. Well, that's going to do it for this week's edition. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thanks to my engineer, Michael Nocella, and to you, the listener, à raison d'être. Next week, Denise Young is in the host seat. Stay tuned now for Wake Up and Stay Woke with Dr. E. Faye Williams. Ashe.
Hi, this is Robin Holden.
Hi, this is Miyuki Williams.
WPFW programmers Miyuki Williams, Robin Holden, Craig Williams, Jim Byers, Verna Avery Brown, James Funk, Captain Fly, Tom Cole, Bill Wax, Kim Bay, Millie Ware, Joni Eisenberg, Arthur McLeod, Donald Temple, Bill Starr, Lona Elias, Ron Pinchback, David Whetstone, DJ Abby, DJ Divine, and Willard Jenkins will celebrate you at Washington's premier jazz club, Tacoma Station, 6914 4th Street, Northwest Washington, D.C. This is a musical tribute on Sunday, May 26, from 5 until 9 p.m.
This event features internationally renowned bassist Michael Bowie, Hope Udobie on keyboards, Charles Wilson drums, Grace J and Sing Steph on vocals, and others.
Please come and join your favorite programmers for some great jazz, food, cocktails, and a little dancing for a Sunday jazz happy hour you will never forget.
The event happens at the Tacoma Station Jazz Club, 6914 4th Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., a musical fundraising tribute, Sunday, May 26, 5 until 9 p.m. The tickets are $50, and there are only 100 tickets for this VIP event. Secure your tickets to the Jazz Happy Hour.
Tickets are available at Eventbrite. When in Eventbrite, please search WPFW Tacoma Station. We're looking forward to celebrating you on Sunday, May 26, from 5 until 9 p.m. at Tacoma Station.
It takes volunteers to keep jazz and justice alive in the DMV. And WPFW is in need of listeners' participation in our spring membership drive by answering phones and entering data from May 12th through the 25th. It's a fun opportunity to meet WPFW's staff and WPFW's host of your favorite shows.
Are you a student in need of community service or a member of an organization that loves volunteering? If so, we're calling on you. You can contact our volunteer coordinator, Vinnie Jack, at volunteers@wpfw.org or call at 202-588-0999, extension 360. Show your love for WPFW by volunteering today. Thank you.
The best in live music entertainment is coming this spring to Bethesda Theater. Also coming is Trouble Funk, featuring go-go legend Big Tony, celebrating his birthday by performing all their go-go classics on Friday, May 3rd at 9 p.m. And on Mother's Day, it's Howard Hewitt performing his own popular songs and those by Shalimar, for two shows on Sunday, May 12th at 3 p.m. and 7 p.m. Trouble Funk, featuring Big Tony on May 3rd and Howard Hewitt on Mother's Day, May 12th. Get more information on all shows at BethesdaTheater.com. WPFW is a proud media partner with Bethesda Theater.
Education, art, health, music, politics, and all things community.
Yes!
Join me, Ambrose Lane Jr., as we uncover the issues of D.C. communities east of the river on To the East, Mondays at 5 p.m. right here on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW 89.3 FM.
WPFW is looking for a new place to hang our hats and microphones. And we're betting that members of WPFW's In the Know listening community, folks like you, may know of spaces where we might make our new home. Have you walked past or know of a cool space that appears to be for lease? Hip us to it. Know of something that's not yet on the market? We're all ears. Your station for Jazz and Justice requires 2,200 square feet of space in Washington, D.C. or immediate environs. Metro accessible with nearby parking. We value your suggestions and observations as we embark on this vital mission. Email your tips to wpfw.lsb.relocation@gmail.com. And thanks for all you do to nourish and sustain WPFW, building a better